With protesters gathered there in San Francisco this morning, commentator Frank DeFord has this longer view of the torch relay.
There's something wonderfully ironic about the Olympic torch, which is making its journey about the world now, rather as if it has a big kick me sign on it for China. Ah, what goes around. The torch relay was conjured up by the Nazis for the 1936 Olympics and then embedded in our dreamy Olympic consciousness by the magnificent Gossamer photography of Leni Riefenstahl, Hitler's favorite movie maker. Now, three-quarters of a century later, it has come back as an unexpected curse to haunt another totalitarian government to which the International Olympic Committee has hitched its wagon. The ignominy that China is enduring with protests that are like moths to the torch where'er it goes will far exceed whatever positive attention China might receive when the Olympics are in the world limelight for a fortnight in the dead of summer. The reflected heat from the torch uproar will also help expose what a humbug the IOC can be. This is the organization which loves to call itself a movement. Come on, would we accept it at face value if Commissioner Bud Selig stood up and crowed about the Major League Baseball movement? Would we bow our heads if Mayor Oscar Goodman asked us to pay homage to the Las Vegas Strip movement? It gets serious, but there's no real difference with our sanctimonious Olympic friends. Only the IOC still calls itself a movement and gets away with it. Hey, it's no more than an international cartel that puts on a big show every 4 years. It's just NASCAR with accents. And tell you the truth, I think the Olympics are yesterday's party. Once upon a time, before globalism and jet airplanes and cyberspace, bringing athletes together quadrantally in one place might have made sense. Today, it's an unnecessary excess. And while insular Americans might not understand this, the World Cup of Soccer has become much more important to many more people in the world. The Olympics has really ended up as a festival for those sports that nobody much cares about for the other 3 years and 50 weeks. The showcase is track and field. How many of you can even name a single American track athlete? How many of you can name a single track athlete from any nation? The Olympics is a symphony orchestra without the violins and brass. But hooray for the Olympic athletes. Please, please, everybody, just threaten boycott, but let the athletes all go to Beijing and have their day in the smog. It was so unfair when, in 1980, President Carter sacrificed our Olympians to make a point against the Soviet Union. But as the torch wends its way, spreading the bad news, I really think we might be seeing more than a censure of China. We may also be witness to the start of the real decline of the Olympics. I love London. I wish it hadn't got itself stuck with the 2012 Games. I love Chicago. I hope it gets lucky and doesn't get stuck with the 2016 Games. Every dog has its day. No movement is perpetual.
Okay, the comments of Frank DeFord. His latest novel, The Entitled, is now in paperback. He joins us from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
If you've ever gone to an internet search engine like Google and typed in a few words hoping to find information, you have an idea what's at stake in this next story. It involves an effort to block some searches on a computer database. Reproductive health researchers have access to a specialized database. They search it more or less the same way you search the internet. But something happened to that database, funded by the government and maintained by Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Researchers were puzzled last week when a search for one term kept coming up empty. And this morning, we have more on the story. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports on what led the database to restrict searches involving the word abortion.
It all started when Gloria Wan, a librarian at the University of San Francisco, conducted a search on abortion for researchers using Popline, the world's largest database on reproductive health services. Wan told her boss, Gail Sorrow, what was happening.
She was doing an update of the search in the Popline database. She got fewer citations than the first time that she ran the search, which is unusual. So she contacted Popline, and the Popline administrator said, yes, they had decided to turn the term abortion into a stop word.
Search engines ignore stop words.
The average user would go to the database and you would throw in abortion and you would get zero.
Soro complained to the administrator of Popline and to others.
Because abortion is a perfectly good noun. There's nothing wrong with it. And we sent it out to some other medical library listservs, so lots of medical librarians would know about this because this impacts your work. And then it just spiraled after that.
The federal agency that funds Popline, the U.S. Agency for International Development, cannot by law support abortion activities. Sandra Jordan of USAID says abortion statistics and research, however, are acceptable. But she says the agency did have problems with some materials on the site.
The materials on Popline about which USAID made its inquiry were abortion advocacy materials. Afterwards, Popline administrators then made the decision to restrict abortion as a search term.
So you did not ask them to, or USAID did not ask them to remove abortion as a search term?
No.
When the dean of Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, Michael Clagg, found out about the block, the search function for abortion was restored. After completing an inquiry, Clagg said yesterday that the block was an overreaction and identified the materials in question as seven articles in A, the abortion magazine. It is published by IPAS, an international reproductive rights organization. Executive Director Anu Kumar knew about the block, but didn't know it had anything to do with her organization.
We are disappointed, and we find it very unfortunate that under this administration, we can't even talk about abortion. We know that 40 million abortions take place every year, and nearly 20 million of them are unsafe. I mean, women are literally dying while we are dithering about these words.
The issue that led to the block focused on abortion as a human rights issue that included profiles of abortion rights advocates around the world. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Mary Roach has written a book about sex, nonfiction. It's about sex research. At this point, you would expect an assurance that this is a serious book, clinical, not comical. And you would be wrong, because it is both clinical and comical. Mary Roach is a solid science journalist with a glorious sense of humor. That's probably why the title of her book is Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. She last talked with us here about her book on cadavers. It was called Stiff. A warning, this interview includes references, mostly sober references, to sex organs and also to polyester. In Bonk, Roach explores the current state and the history of research into human sexuality, and she drafts her husband into service as a study subject with her. She also introduces readers to trailblazers in the field, some of whom I'd heard of, Alfred Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, but there were some I hadn't heard of, like Robert Latou Dickinson, a Brooklyn-based physician.
Robert Latou Dickinson was a phenomenal man. He was a gynecologist working in the 1890s through about the 1930s. He's actually the man who got Kinsey interested in sex. Kinsey had been studying gall wasp speciation, had no inkling of what lay ahead for him, then met this man, Robert Latou Dickinson. In his gynecological practice, Dickinson began asking patients systematically about their sex lives and not, you know, how is it, but what do you do and how do you have an orgasm and how are things going for you? And so he had these detailed case studies, and he began to see that there were a lot of very unhappy and unsatisfied people. And he began going further along and actually started doing some physiological testing. And back then there wasn't a lot of fancy equipment. So Dr. Dickinson at one point became interested in what exactly goes on inside people when they're having sex. And he used a test tube. He actually inserted it and would shine a light so he could actually see what was going on in there. That if the test tube were standing in for the penis, then you would see, you know, where is it hitting? Is it hitting the cervix? And there was, at the time, it was believed that the penis actually interlocked with the cervix, which is not true. Mm-hmm. And he could see that, in fact, it wasn't even hitting anywhere near the head of the cervix. And he was able to sort of debunk the coital interlocking theory. So he was really the first man to take a really scientific laboratory approach to figuring out what happens when people have sex.
And he was doing this in the early decades of the 20th century. And he, I mean, do we know if lots of his patients were turning him down and were put off by these questions, or were they all...
As far as I could tell, they were amazingly cooperative. I went to one of the archives where his some of his files are, and he kept these detailed note cards with the responses that people were giving him, and they were very, very forthcoming. And seemed to have no qualms about it. And this is, I think, actually, the 1920s were a surprisingly open-minded and freewheeling era. This was before the 40s and 50s when we swung back the other way. The 1920s, there were sex manuals at the time that were encouraging women to try being on top. They were talking about the clitoris. The 1920s were almost like the 60s in a way. And then we swung back to a more conservative era.
Now, as you said, Dr. Dickinson, Dr. Robert Luther Dickinson, was the person whose work inspired Alfred Kinsey. In passing, you note, I'm reading a quote now, I give you a sentence, my favorite sentence in the entire oeuvre of Alfred Kinsey from Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Quote, cheese crumbs spread in front of a copulating pair of rats may distract the female, but not the male.
That's my favorite, yes. He was making the point that the female, the human female he was talking about, is more prone to distraction during sex. He was talking about, in general, the male and the female to a certain extent. When you're very, very aroused, a tremendous amount of stuff can be going on around you and you won't notice. Your peripheral vision kind of cuts out. You don't notice if somebody's, you know, picking your pocket, and prostitutes have used this to great benefit. You don't feel pain nearly as much. Mm-hmm. Something that would be painful otherwise is just sort of registers as a mild tactile stimulation. So anyway, it was in that passage of the book that he mentioned the copulating rats and the cheese crumbs.
One of the more exotic studies that you write about was published in, was it European Urology, by an Egyptian doctor?
Yes. That was my favorite study of all time. Dr. Shafik, he's an extraordinary gentleman in that he funds his own research. He's a surgeon, but he's done a lot of research in the realm, the whole pelvic area. So he's done proctology, urology, andrology, sexology. And I came across him kind of arbitrarily. I found this paper in which he was looking at the effects of polyester fabric on the fertility and incidence of copulation in rats. And
I didn't know that rats wore polyester.
Well, normally they don't, but in Dr. Shafik's lab, he actually outfitted laboratory rats in tiny little polyester trousers. And there's a little diagram in the paper. And this is a legitimate research paper published in a peer-reviewed journal. And there's a line drawing of a rat wearing these tiny little trousers, and on the caption says, the underpant worn by the rat.
I gather Dr. Shafik passed away last year, you told me.
Yes, in October he passed away.
And he found in that particular study that wearing polyester, wearing polyester diminished the fertility of the rats, but you at least admit the possibility that perhaps he was just wearing anything or dressing funny might also diminish the fertility of anyone.
Yes, the incidence of copulations, I think, whether you're a rat or a human male wearing those trousers. I mean, you kind of need to see the trousers, but there's a little hole for the tail and they're drawstring at the top and they're not very attractive. And I think it would be kind of hard to get a date in that case, yes.
Well, after meeting people like Dr. Shafik in Cairo and you and your husband taking part in a study with Dr. Dang in London and so many other interviews you report on in the book. I mean, what do you come away? What's the takeaway knowledge you have from having written Bonk?
Well, I think that one of the things that I'm left with is a lingering sense of surprise that there are still a good number of mysteries in the realm of sexual physiology. You kind of have the sense that as a person who has sex, you figure, well, you know, it seems to work. What else do we need to know? Which is kind of a ridiculous attitude. That would be like somebody saying to a person who's studying, say, the esophageal sphincter, well, we all know how to eat. Why do we need to study that? Mm-hmm. So I come up against that all the time. People saying, well, what's the point of this research? You know, tell me something I don't know about sex. We don't know, for example, the mechanisms of ejaculation, what the trigger is for that. And there have been all kinds of elaborate and quite frightening little studies that have been done in that realm. Just any number of things that we really should still be looking into, and yet it's very difficult for sex researchers to get funding for purely anatomical and physiological research these days.
Well, Mary Roach, author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And you can read more about rodents and synthetic clothing, and you can hear Mary give me the scoop on her own experience as an ultrasound imaging guinea pig at our website, npr.org.
In Atlanta, hip-hop meets ballet tomorrow night.
The Atlanta Ballet's latest show is a collaboration between old-school dance
and new-school music, specifically the beats and rhymes of Antoine Big Boy Patton of the popular Atlanta duo Outkast.
Day-to-Day producer Shireen Meraji spent time with the performers while they were fine-tuning the show, simply titled Big.
I be on it all night, man. I be on it all day. Straight up pimp. If you want me, you can find me in the air.
Dance studio doors vibrate to the deep bass of Big Boy's kryptonite. Peek behind those doors and you'll find ballet choreographer Laurie Stallings directing the movements of a crew of young dancers from the Atlanta Ballet. A featherweight ballerina twists and turns above the heads and under the arms of four male dancers. Her movements are ethereal, but it's also like she's teetering over a cliff's edge, right about to fall. Laurie Stallings says Antoine Big Boy Patton's music forces her to say something meaningful with her choreography.
The work is fundamentally based on the contrasts that make up the American dream. I think I've been waiting for this music for a long time, actually. It's like any classical composition. It's intricate and layered and beautiful and ugly, and there's so much texture. So if Mozart was here, I think he'd really dig this.
Dancing in toe shoes to a song about smoking weed is definitely a contrast. Atlanta Ballet's artistic director John McFall said when he was first floating the idea of collaborating with a hip-hop act, patrons were a little freaked out about the lyrics.
So people were pushing back pretty hard at times. It's not a fairyland. Alcohol and drugs are part of our lifestyle, whether they're legal or not. There is some pretty interesting language in some of the tracks that we're using. You know, that's representative of a culture, and I actually call it poetry.
I must admit, they planted a lot of things in the brains and the veins of my strain. Makes it hard to refrain from the host of cocaine, from them whores, from the flame, from a post in the game. Makes it hard to maintain focus.
Rehearsals for Big are an aural and visual culture clash, with Stallings, a wisp of a woman standing 5 feet tall, no more than 100 pounds, explaining her choreography to hip-hop lyricists like Big Rube, heard here on Outkast Liberation. They call him Big Rube for a reason. He's at least 5 times Stallings' size, baggy jeans, gold chain, and you can't leave out the shiny gold mouth grill.
A dancer comes on stage and they're making graffiti on stage, they're painting, and you walk through that environment as he's doing his work.
Right. Maybe the rough edginess of hip-hop is now, you know, definitely being accepted as a legitimate art form, and anybody who maybe isn't seeing that, you know, the writing's on the wall. You know what I'm saying? Something like that, maybe.
Fantastic.
The obvious writing on the wall is that the fine arts like ballet aren't doing well financially. Patrons are getting older, and ballet companies need to attract newer, younger audiences. And in Atlanta, hip-hop is king. Think Ludacris, T.I., Lil Jon, Jermaine Dupri, and of course, Outkast.
Yeah, international, underground, thunderbounce when I stomp the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback, orangutans, you can't stop a train.
They are the super talented and innovative hip-hop duo. Hip-hop icons, really. When NPR's diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster claims to have one of their CDs, you know they've crossed over. And if you've forgotten their names, here's a reminder. Andre 3000 of Hey Ya fame and Antoine Big Boy Patton. He likes the way ballet dancers move.
The music in itself has no boundaries, so ballet could be thrown in anywhere. You know what I'm saying? Because we utilize every genre of music, from heavy metal to hip-hop to reggae to jazz to country to folk to gospel. You know what I mean? So Why not?
It's 10 p.m. when Big Boy arrives for work at his Atlanta studio, where friends and family like his Uncle Mooney and Cousin Tafani chill in the back room, known as the Courvoisier Lounge. His conclusion? Art is art. And regardless of race and social class, hip-hop culture and ballet culture aren't so different.
They come to the studio and we sit in this room right here and go through music. It's like that mental sign language that Laura and Big Rube were intertwined, and me and Laura do the same thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, I can see her. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. She's very animated. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, without even saying words, we can kind of connect and know, like, okay, let's use this record right here. And that brought us to using one of the new songs off my album. Actually, it's going to close out the ballet. They happen to be in here one night late. So they do the night owl thing too, late. And I was working on a record, and I was like, oh my God, what is that? I was like, this is new. They was like, you think it's just something else.
Big Boy believes so much in the collaboration that he's unveiling a song off of his unreleased album. But can Outkast music really bring a new audience to the ballet? One thing is obvious. This is not the Nutcracker.
Right. Yeah, they come see me. Because the only ballet experience I've ever had was the Nutcracker. When I was in elementary school, and like now to have my own show, story, interpretation of just vibes and positive energy. Like, I love it. I thrive off of that. For sure.
For NPR News, I'm Shereen Meraji.
Big Boy was talking all about his new track, but you can't hear it unless you go to Atlanta's Fox Theater tomorrow night to see the show.
If you can't make it, go to our website, npr.org, to see photos of the dancers in action. Our program is produced by Chip Grabo and edited by Martha Little. The director is Kimin Song.
The day-to-day production staff includes Catherine Fox, Steve Prophet, Deborah Clark, Shereen Meraji, Martina Castro, Vanessa Romo, Allison Gilbert, Ronnie Radbill, and Jolie Myers. And special thanks this week to Javon Paris for additional production help.
Our editors are Jacob Conrad, Jason DeRose, Laura Dine, and Jim Wallace. Our technical director is Leo Del Aguila with engineer Sean Corey Campbell.
The day-to-day theme was composed by Greg Smith. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen.
When the wind, she was my friend, like Princess died before she died. Therefore, we tried and tried again. But in the end, you pay attention to the pluses, but the minuses behind it make it seem like you can't win.
Before they crashed, those big financial firms had an unquenchable thirst for subprime loans, and that created a big opportunity for mortgage brokers. The industry is lightly regulated at best, and many brokers made piles of fast, easy money off the lending frenzy. NPR's Chris Arnold takes us into their world, where people could get rich peddling risky loans.
If you want a window into how so many people got into crazy loans, meet Amber Barbosa. Barbosa didn't graduate college. She cut her teeth working for the now infamous subprime lender New Century Mortgage. A few years later, she struck out on her own as a mortgage broker, and she was doing really well.
In 06, I made close to $500,000.
And how old were you?
I just turned 30, so 28.
So you're 28 years old, you're making $500,000 a year selling subprime loans.
Yeah.
By then, Barbosa had a nice boat, a 27-foot Bayliner, several houses, nice cars. She was living outside of San Francisco.
I was riding around in my 07 Escalade, had another Mercedes, a CLS 500. God, I had three properties at the time, one right on the water with ocean access, another property for about $800,000. I was living.
We checked the property records, and Barbosa really did own those houses. Since the bottom fell out, though, she says she's pretty much lost everything. But back then, brokers like her were working next to a river of money, and all they had to do was reach in and grab some. Basically, the more costly and risky the loans that they gave to their customers, the more money they made. Barbosa thinks she was pretty fair to her clients.
When you would shop a loan, you'd tell your client, hey, I'm going to get you the best deal out there based on your particular circumstance.
But Barbosa says there were a lot of incentives to screw customers over. Lenders would offer her 1 or 2% of the price of the loan as a kickback if she got her client to take a higher interest rate. That was legal and commonplace. Then there were the negative AM or pick-a-payment loans. Those had low payment options, but later often exploded on the homeowner, costing them very high rates.
The bottom line is that the lender offered an incentive of 3% to the broker if they put them into that particular loan.
So on a $500,000 home in California, brokers made $15,000 to $20,000 or more in kickbacks on every single one of these risky loans.
So, I mean, obviously, tons of people got, you know, pushed in or thrown into that particular loan or in that direction.
Barbosa talked to us at a training at the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, or NACA. Some out-of-work mortgage brokers have now found their way to nonprofits like this one. NACA's working with borrowers facing foreclosure all over the country, refinancing or restructuring their unaffordable subprime loans.
We have over 100,000 people coming through the process here, gang, so, you know.
Bruce Marks heads up this nonprofit and now helps retrain these former subprime loan brokers. He says who better to now put to work untangling these unaffordable loans, the 228 exploding arms, the pick-a-pays.
They are the experts because they were part of that industry and they know that business inside and out.
Some of the brokers here saw some shady stuff going on in that industry. Anthony Narag worked as a loan officer for several different mortgage brokerage outfits in Southern California. He says everybody in the industry knew that there was fraud all over the place.
It was almost like baseball with steroids. They knew about it, but they didn't do anything about it.
Narag says take stated income loans. These were designed for self-employed people, but most people who got them were not self-employed. They or their broker just exaggerated their income to justify a big loan set to adjust to a high interest rate. Narag says to do that, they sometimes needed a supporting letter from a certified public accountant. He says an account executive from the now bankrupt lender New Century told brokers like him not to worry about that letter.
He would tell people, I have a CPA in my back pocket if you need one.
And what did that mean? I've got a CPA in my...
It means if you didn't have a CPA letter, he had one for you that he could call, he'll take care of.
Meaning Narag says he'd get you a bogus CPA letter. New Century declined to comment. Beyond that one company, Narag says he saw brokers printing up fake bank statements or other income documents. There was a black market for fake bank statements.
I've seen it, you know. I had people who were so good at it that I used to work with. They would say, hey, Anthony, if you ever need anything, bank statements, let me know. Here's the fee, you know. It could range anywhere between like $500 to $2,500 to fix a bank summons.
To get bogus documents?
Yes.
One broker says he knew a teller at a local bank who would sell doctored statements. And Narag says everybody, including the lenders and banks buying these loans, looked the other way because the money was so good. Narag got into the business himself after buying his own house. He saw that his loan officer wore shorts, didn't work that hard, and raked in money. So Narag quit his job as a sales manager. He says even keeping his nose clean and not gouging his customers.
I couldn't believe the money I was making. I was probably making $10,000 to $15,000 a month easily. And it was great.
Narag says brokers that gouged their clients made much more, and there were a lot of deceptive sales tactics. Daryl Tony worked at a local mortgage outfit in Chicago that had dozens of brokers selling subprime loans.
That used car salesman field, they were ruthless.
Tony says he was taught to give homeowners the hard sell to get them into aggressive, high-interest loans, even if it meant refinancing them out of much better fixed-rate loans that they could afford. Tony says he wasn't dishonest, but he says a lot of the other brokers were, telling people these risky, adjustable loans had fixed rates.
The minimum payment was fixed for 12 months. So when they say, oh, is this fixed? You know, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's fixed. Sign here.
Tony says he didn't do that, but before he figured out just how bad these adjustable loans were, he says he did convince people to take them. After a year of working as a subprime mortgage broker, Tony was getting calls from customers who couldn't afford their loans. The market was falling, and he couldn't refinance them or help them, so he says he quit.
I couldn't go forward, you know. There's not enough money, you know, for me to compromise, you know, my integrity. Or at least to continue to, you know, to compromise it, unfortunately.
The situation is complicated. Some people were clearly lied to and cheated. Others knowingly borrowed recklessly or just bought way too much house. Many people are somewhere in between. Amber Barbosa says as an independent broker, she was straight with people, but she says a lot of homeowners just wanted cash out of their homes and a low payment, even if the rate was set to adjust much higher.
I explained all the terms to them. They knew about the adjustments. They knew the fees they were being paid. We never hid anything from them at all. I mean, it was definitely full disclosure. They just wanted their money. They wanted the deal to close. Whatever we would say to them, they would take the loan anyway.
Barbosa, Tony, and Narag all say they're happy to be starting their new jobs as mortgage brokers with a nonprofit. Now they'll be helping people who can afford a reasonable interest rate to save their homes. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. From California to New England, wind energy is booming. Consumers and lawmakers are demanding more renewable energy, and the result is an unprecedented growth in wind farms. From a distance, the spinning turbines can seem beautiful, but in some communities, living with them has gotten a bit ugly. Continuing our series, Shifting Ground, independent producer David Barron has the story of one family blown apart by the wind.
A snow-covered road rises from the Black River Valley onto Tug Hill in Lewis County, New York. This is Yancey Road, home to the Yancey family for generations.
My parents lived here, and my grandfather lived here.
John Yancey has lived here his whole life. He's 48. And he's not pleased with the recent changes in the neighborhood.
We've got nothing but windmills.
Windmills surround him.
We'll start here on the north. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
The turbines are white, sleek, enormous, 20 stories tall, with blades 3 times longer than a Greyhound bus.
42, 43.
Almost 200 turbines sprawl across an area larger than Manhattan. This is the Maple Ridge Wind Farm, the largest wind power facility in the East. It opened 2 years ago, and it's transformed the way this rural area looks and sounds.
You'll hear that whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
John Yancey says when the wind comes from the right direction, the sound penetrates his house, his bedroom, his consciousness.
I don't sleep.
Most of the noise comes from one turbine. It's just across the street. And what makes it especially upsetting, the turbine is on his father's land.
I asked him not to have it installed there, to ask the company to either move it or delete it. But they built it, and now I have to suffer with it.
John and a couple of his brothers are angry at their father for allowing 7 turbines on his land. One brother, Herb Yancey, grows corn and hay on his father's farm. He says the wind towers and their access roads have fragmented the land.
And now you have all these little fields with no straight borders on them anyplace. It made farming a nightmare.
Then there's their brother, Gordon. He owns a nearby inn that's popular with snowmobilers. He used to enjoy an unobstructed view of the Adirondacks. Now he looks out on the wind towers.
They've taken away my peacefulness, my serenity, my ability to walk outside on my property and enjoy the quietness of the morning sun, the quietness of the setting sun.
And Gordon barely speaks to his father anymore.
I feel that he sold the family out.
My name is Edward Yancey. I was born in 1916.
Ed Yancey's hearing isn't so good, and when I ask him about the turbines that have divided him from his sons, it's not clear he understands. But there's a simple reason he agreed to windmills on his land. He receives lease payments of more than $45,000 a year.
It helps out. Helps pay the taxes.
His daughter, Virginia Yancey Leindecker, sides with her father in this family dispute. She says he would have been foolish not to lease his land for wind towers.
My theory is if they're all going to be around you and you're going to see them, and if you got the property, you might as well partake, because why should you go and say, I'm too important to take money?
Money, fairness, a sense that decisions were not made democratically. These are the core issues that explain the Yancey family rift, and it's a rift that split the broader community, too. Many people here like the wind farm. It's brought jobs and tax dollars. Some consider the turbines beautiful. But resentment has bubbled up because those who have a lot of land and a lot of windmills make a lot of money, while their land-poor neighbors receive next to nothing.
It has caused friction, family against family or neighbor against neighbor.
Arlie Rice is town supervisor for Lowville, New York, one of the 3 towns that host the Maple Ridge Wind Farm. Wind projects have now been proposed for other communities in the region, and residents of those towns often seek his advice.
When I go other places, I say, just sit down and think how you can benefit everyone.
Okay, well, let's do this. Why don't you come up and get a sheet of paper and a marker?
That question, how to make wind power something everyone can benefit from, was put recently to an eighth grade science class at Lowville's middle school. The teacher, Debbie Yancey, Herb's wife, Ed's daughter-in-law. She broke the students into teams.
Okay, and we're talking windmills, guys, windmills.
The students came up with several ideas for improving wind farm development. Among them, require that windmills be set back farther from neighboring homes, hold a town vote on whether to allow the project, and don't let wind power companies negotiate deals one-on-one with individual landowners.
They got to do it as a community thing.
They have to do it as a community thing.
Yeah. It'd make the windmills better because
the community would get that money.
And then they could figure out where they wanted to plant them. If someone didn't want it, it didn't need to be there. It could go somewhere else.
Go somewhere else, okay. So everybody's kind of all in it together.
It's a win-win situation.
A win-win situation.
But wind power does involve trade-offs, and they're not always easy. How do you weigh the potential harm to neighbors against the benefit to the planet? Is it worth giving up the view you're used to in exchange for economic gains? Such questions don't just divide communities and families. They sometimes leave individuals internally conflicted. John Yancey, who's so upset about the windmill across the street that keeps him up nights, he's a union electrician. He helped build the wind towers.
They needed manpower, and our union supplied it.
Did you work on the ones on your dad's land?
Yes, I did. I thought that it possibly would be something that I'd be proud to say that, yes, I helped build this turbine across the road, but now I'm eating my words.
And now that the windmills have come, John Yancey says he may go and leave his home on Yancey Road. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
And you can hear more stories from the Shifting Ground series at our website, npr.org.
Support for the series Shifting Ground comes from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy.